Let's go now live to the news conference. This is the Prime Minister of Portugal.
The leaders are three friends and allied countries, the United States, Spain, and the United Kingdom. President Bush, Prime Minister Aznar, and Prime Minister Tony Blair. This meeting in the Azores also shows the importance of transatlantic relations and also shows the solidarity among our countries. Actually, this agreement has approved two statements. One statement on transatlantic relations and a statement on Iraq. We have joined this initiative and we organized it here in the Azores because we thought this was the last opportunity for a political solution. And this is how we see it. This is the last possibility for a political solution to the problem. Maybe it's a small chance, a small possibility, but even if it's 1 in 1 million, it's always worthwhile fighting for a political solution. And I think this is the message that we can get from this Atlantic summit. As I was saying, for my English-speaking guests, I'll speak English now.
George Bush.
Em primeiro lugar, deixe-me dizer bem-vindo, George Bush, na Europa. É importante que nos reunamos aqui, num país europeu, em Portugal, mas em seu
Well, obviously, there's a mix-up in the feed. Now we're getting the Portuguese translation. Earlier, we were hearing the Portuguese translation into English. This is José Durão Barroso, the Prime Minister of Portugal, speaking.
Tem também significado político, pois significa a nossa amizade, significa a nossa amizade e o nosso comprometimento político. Bem-vindo a todos. Passo a palavra a George Bush. Muito obrigado por sua hospitalidade. Organizou muito bem esta conferência em pouco tempo. É uma honra para mim.
As we work toward a great cause, and that is peace and security in this world. We've had a really good discussion. We've been doing a lot of phone talking, and it was good to get together and to visit and to talk. And we concluded that tomorrow is a moment of truth for the world. Many nations have voiced a commitment to peace and security, and now they must demonstrate that commitment to peace and security in the only effective way, by supporting the immediate and unconditional disarmament of Saddam Hussein. The dictator of Iraq and his weapons of mass destruction are a threat to the security of free nations. He is a danger to his neighbors. He's a sponsor of terrorism. He's an obstacle to progress in the Middle East. For decades, he has been the cruel, cruel oppressor of the Iraq people. On this very day, 15 years ago, Saddam Hussein launched a chemical weapons attack on the Iraqi village of Halabja. With a single order, the Iraqi regime killed thousands of men and women and children, without mercy or without shame. Saddam Hussein has proven he is capable of any crime. We must not permit his crimes to reach across the world. Saddam Hussein has a history of mass murder. He possesses the weapons of mass murder. He agreed to disarm Iraq of these weapons as a condition for ending the Gulf War over a decade ago. The United Nations Security Council and Resolution 1441 has declared Iraq in material breach of its long-standing obligations, demanded once again Iraq's full and immediate disarmament, and promised serious consequences if the regime refused to comply. That resolution was passed unanimously, and its logic is inescapable. The Iraqi regime will disarm itself, or the Iraqi regime will be disarmed by force. And the regime has not disarmed itself. Action to remove the threat from Iraq would also allow the Iraqi people to build a better future for their society. And Iraq's liberation would be the beginning, not the end, of our commitment to its people. We will supply humanitarian relief, bring the economic sanctions to a swift close, and work for the long-term recovery of Iraq's economy. We'll make sure that Iraq's natural resources are used for the benefit of their owners, the Iraqi people. Iraq has the potential to be a great nation. Iraq's people are skilled and educated. We'll push as quickly as possible for an Iraqi interim authority to draw upon the talents of Iraq's people to rebuild their nation. We're committed to the goal of a unified Iraq with democratic institutions in which members of all ethnic and religious groups are treated with dignity and respect. To achieve this vision, we will work closely with the international community, including the United Nations and our coalition partners. If military force is required, we will quickly seek new Security Council resolutions to encourage broad participation in the process of helping the Iraqi people to build a free Iraq. Crucial days lie ahead for the world. I want to thank the leaders here today and many others for stepping forward and taking leadership and showing their resolve in the cause of peace and in the cause of security. Jose Maria.
Next is the Prime Minister of Spain.
Good evening, everyone. I would firstly like to thank the Prime Minister, José Manuel Durao, for his hospitality and welcome, which I particularly am grateful for. And I'm very pleased to be here in the Azores once again. I have some short remarks on our debates, on this situation and on the documents we have agreed on during today's meeting. I'd first like to refer to our document on Atlantic solidarity. We have renewed our Atlantic commitment on our common values and principles in favor of democracy, freedom, and the rule of law. We understand that the expression of this commitment is essential by way of guarantee of peace, security, and international freedom. And I honestly believe that there is no other alternative to the expression of the Atlantic commitment in terms of security. We are committed on a day-to-day fight against new threats such as terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, and tyrannic regimes that do not comply with international law. They threaten all of us, and we must all act consequently. This transatlantic link, this transatlantic solidarity has always been, is, and should continue to be, in my opinion, a great European commitment. And as such, amongst other things, we express it this way. Without this commitment, today's Europe could not be understood. And without that commitment, it would be very difficult to picture the Europe of tomorrow. So I would like to invite our friends, our allies, to leave aside any circumstantial differences and to work together seriously for that commitment of democracy, freedom, and peace, so that this becomes a commitment of us all. We've agreed on launching, on boosting the Middle East peace process, and on our vision that that peace process has to culminate with all necessary security guarantees and putting an end to terrorism. And this should end with the peaceful coexistence of two states, an independent Palestinian state and the Israeli state. In view of the situation created by Iraq, with their continued non-compliance of international law, I would like to remind you that we all said before we came here that we were not coming to the Azores to make a declaration of war, that we were coming after having made every possible effort, after having made this effort, continuing to make this effort, to working and to achieve the greatest possible agreement, and for international law to be respected and for UN resolutions to be respected. And we would like to say that we are aware of the fact that this is the last opportunity, expressed in Resolution 1441, adopted unanimously by the Security Council, and that being aware that this is the last opportunity, we are also making the last effort, and we are ready to make this last effort of the very many efforts we've been making throughout these last weeks and months. We are well aware of the international world public opinion, of its concern, and we are also very well aware of our responsibilities and obligations. If Saddam Hussein wants to disarm and avoid the serious consequences of which he has been warned about by the United Nations, he can do so, and nothing in our document nor in our statement can prevent him from doing so if he wants to. So his is the sole responsibility. Tony.
Thank you, Jose Maria.
And now Tony Blair of Britain.
Thank you for hosting us today. And I think it's worth just returning to the key point, which is our responsibility to uphold the will of the United Nations set out in Resolution 1441 last November. And for 4.5 months now, we have worked hard to get Saddam to cooperate fully, unconditionally, as that resolution demanded. Even some days ago, we were prepared to set out clear tests that allowed us to conclude whether he was cooperating fully or not, with a clear ultimatum to him if he refused to do so. And the reason we approached it in that way is that that is what we agreed in Resolution 1441. This was his final opportunity. He had to disarm unconditionally. Serious consequences would follow if he failed to do so. And this is really the impasse that we have. Because some say there should be no ultimatum, no authorization of force in any new UN resolution. Instead, more discussion in the event of non-compliance. But the truth is that without a credible ultimatum authorizing force in the event of non-compliance, then more discussion is just more delay. With Saddam remaining armed with weapons of mass destruction and continuing a brutal, murderous regime in Iraq. And this game that he is playing is frankly a game that he's played over the last 12 years. Disarmament never happens, but instead the international community is drawn into some perpetual negotiation. Gestures designed to divide the international community, but never real and concrete cooperation leading to disarmament. And there's not a single person on the Security Council that doubts the fact he is not fully cooperating today. Nobody, even those who disagree with the position that we have outlined, is prepared to say there is full cooperation as 1441 demanded. Not a single interview has taken place outside of Iraq, even though 1441 provided for it. Still, no proper production or evidence of the destruction of, for example, just to take one example, the 10,000 liters of anthrax that the inspectors just a week ago said was unaccounted for. And that is why it is so important that the international community at this time gives a strong and unified message. And I have to say that I really believe that hadn't we given that strong message some time ago, Saddam might have realized that the games had to stop. So now we have reached the point of decision. And we make a final appeal for there to be that strong, unified message on behalf of the international community that lays down a clear ultimatum to Saddam that authorizes force if he continues to defy the will of the whole of the international community set out in 1441. We will do all we can in the short time that remains to make a final round of contacts to see whether there is a way through this impasse. But we are in the final stages, because after 12 years of failing to disarm him, now is the time when we have to decide. Two other points briefly on the documents that we've put before you. The first, as the President Afghan was just saying to you a moment ago on, the Transatlantic Alliance is, I think, very important. Some of you will have heard me say this before, but let me just repeat it. I believe that Europe and America should stand together on the big issues of the day. I think it is a tragedy when we don't. And that transatlantic alliance is strong, and we need to strengthen it still further. And secondly, we've set out for you that should it come to conflict, we make a pledge to the people of Iraq. And as President Bush was just saying to you a moment or two ago, it is the people of Iraq who are the primary victims of Saddam. The thousands of children that die needlessly every year, the people locked up in his prisons or executed simply for showing disagreement with the regime, a country that is potentially prosperous, reduced to poverty, 60% of the population reliant on food aid. And what we say is that we will protect Iraq's territorial integrity. We will support representative government that unites Iraq on the democratic basis of human rights and the rule of law. That we will help Iraq rebuild, and not rebuild because of the problems of conflict, where if it comes to that, we will do everything we can to minimize the suffering of the Iraqi people, but rebuild Iraq because of the appalling legacy that the rule of Saddam has left the Iraqi people. And then in particular, Iraq's natural resources remain the property of the people of Iraq. And that wealth should be used for the Iraqi people. It is theirs and will remain so, administered by the UN in the way we set out. And finally, on the Middle East peace process, I welcome very much the statement that President Bush made the other day. I think it's important now. He said he wanted a partner on the Palestinian side. I think the coming appointment of Abu Mazen is so important there. It allows us to take this process forward. The roadmap gives us the way forward. The appointment of Abu Mazen gives us the right partner to take this forward. And I believe that that will demonstrate, and it's important to demonstrate it, particularly at this time, that our approach to people in the Middle East, in that troubled region, is indeed even-handed. And all of us will work to make sure that that vision of a Middle East, two states, Israel confident of its security, a Palestinian state that is viable, comes about and is made reality. Thank you.
And now the Prime Minister of Portugal is asking for questions.
Lusa agency. The interpreters unfortunately cannot hear the question. The interpreters do not hear.
As you're hearing, there are some technical difficulties with the feed, and they're not hearing the question, but it looks as if a question is being posed from the Portuguese press car.
I was asking the Portuguese Prime Minister, how does he see the result of this summit? Does the Prime Minister think that starting now Portugal has more responsibilities with this war that seems to be inevitable? The Prime Minister, the results of the summit, as I described them, and as all the other heads of state and government said it too, this summit is exactly this. This is the last opportunity for a political solution to this very serious problem for the international community. This has been said here. It's been said here that tomorrow we'll start with these last initiatives towards a political solution. And for that reason, I'm very, very happy with the results of this summit. Now, coming to our responsibility in case there is a conflict, I must say that this responsibility falls entirely on the dictator Saddam Hussein. He bears the entire responsibility because he has not respected for all these years international law and consistently violated the UN resolutions. And in that case, if there is a conflict, I want to repeat it once more, Portuguese will be next and side by side with his allies. And the fact that we are here today in the Azores with the United States, with Spain, and with the UK, this is very significant. As it's been said here before, the transatlantic relationship is very, very important, not only for Europe and for the US, but it's very important for the whole world. I remember a few days ago Kofi Annan in the European Council in Brussels said the same thing. He said, this is very important. It's very important for Europe and the U.S. to remain united and not separate, because the world needs U.S. and Europe working together towards the same direction, in the same sense, not only about the security, but also fighting under development and all the other tasks that fall to the international community.
Mr. President, before I ask my question, I just want to nail down one thing so there's no confusion. When you talk about tomorrow being the moment of truth, are you saying that is the
just a question?
We're
trying to work in two questions.
Yes, sir. Because there's one thing we need to make clear, I think. When you say tomorrow is the moment of truth, does that mean tomorrow is the last day that the resolution can be voted up or down, and at the end of the day tomorrow, one way or another, the diplomatic window has closed?
That's what I'm saying.
Thank you, sir. And now for the question.
Now for your question.
That being the case, regardless of whether the resolution goes up or down or gets withdrawn, it seems to me you're going to be facing a moment of truth. Given that, you've already said you don't think there's very much chance Saddam Hussein is going to disarm. And given that, you say you don't think there's very much chance he's going to go into exile. Aren't we going to war here?
Tomorrow is the day that we will determine whether or not diplomacy can work. And we sat and visited about this issue, about how best to spend our time between now and tomorrow. And as Prime Minister Blair said, we'll be working the phones and talking to our partners and talking to those who may not clearly understand the objective. And we'll see how it goes tomorrow. Saddam Hussein can leave the country if he's interested in peace. You see, the decision is his to make. And it has been his to make all along as to whether or not there's the use of the military. He got to decide whether he's going to disarm, and he didn't. He can decide whether he wants to leave the country. These are his decisions to make. And thus far, he has made bad decisions.
Now a question from the Spanish press corps.
I understand that if tomorrow is the day for taking the final decision, that means that you consider that there's no possible way out through the United Nations because a majority does not support a war action. I would like to know, Mr. Blair, Mr. Bush, whether in that military offensive you count on many countries, whether it's going to be the UK and the US carrying out the military offensive. I understand from what Mr. Blair has said that you're counting on the UN for the reconstruction. Are you going to look for other countries through the United Nations? And for Mr. Aznar, What is Spain's participation in that military offensive, in addition to your political support?
1941, which was unanimously approved, that said Saddam Hussein would unconditionally disarm. And if he didn't, there would be serious consequences. The United Nations Security Council looked at the issue 4.5 months ago and voted unanimously to say, disarm immediately and unconditionally. And if you don't, there are going to be serious consequences. The world has spoken, and it did in a unified voice. Sorry.
The issue is very simply this, that we cannot have a situation where what happens through the United Nations, having agreed 1441, having said there will be serious consequences if he doesn't cooperate fully and unconditionally, what we cannot have is a situation where we simply go back for endless discussion. Now, we have provided the right diplomatic way through this, which is to lay down a clear ultimatum to Saddam, cooperate or face disarmament by force. And it's entirely within the logic, the letter, the spirit of 1441. And that is why, you know, all the way through we have tried to provide a diplomatic solution. After over 4.5 months since we passed Resolution 1441, we're now, 3 months on from the declaration that Saddam made on the 8th of December, that not a single person in the international community, not one, believes was an honest declaration of what he had. And yet 1441 said the first step of cooperation was to make an honest declaration. So when people say, have we exhausted all the diplomatic avenues? We've tried exhausting them. But understand from our perspective and from the perspective of the security of the world, we cannot simply go back to the Security Council for this discussion to be superseded by that discussion, to be superseded by another discussion. That's what's happened for 12 years. That's why he's still got the weapons of mass destruction. We have to come to the point of decision. And that really is what the next period of time is going to be about.
Well, I would like to say that this statement we're making today, as we've all said, is one, it's a last chance, one last attempt to reach the greatest possible consensus amongst ourselves. And I can assure all of you that we have all made enormous efforts to all, and we're going to continue making these efforts in order to try to reach an agreement, to reach a solution. We have our own worry, our own responsibility to make UN resolutions be abided by. If the Security Council unanimously adopts a resolution, Resolution 1441, giving one last opportunity to disarm to someone who has weapons of mass destruction, and we know he has used them, the Security Council cannot, 1 year after the other, wait for its resolutions to be implemented. That is, would be the best way to do away with it altogether. And it would be a good way to do away with all the United Nations credibility. And we honestly don't want that to happen. To me, there is no... You cannot have the same distance between illegality and impunity. And neither Saddam Hussein nor any other tyrant with weapons of mass destruction can set the rules for international law
that
and
last,
the international community.
That last comment from Prime Minister Aznar of Spain.
Can I ask, first of all, Prime Minister Blair, you've said that you want a second resolution to be put down and voted on. Can we be clear, is that what's going to happen tomorrow under all circumstances? And either way, also if I may, for President Bush, if you don't get that second resolution, what is the future for the United Nations? You've talked about Saddam Hussein dividing the world community. Surely he's succeeded.
Well, on your last point, I think this is one of the things that is tragic about this situation. That Saddam plays these games, and we carry on allowing him to play them. Now, we will do in the next period of time, in respect of the resolution, what we believe to be in the interests of the UN. But I want to say why I think it is so important that even now, at this late stage, we try to get the United Nations to be the root of resolving this. Because the threat is there and everyone accepts it. The threat of weapons of mass destruction, the threat of weapons of mass destruction in the hands of terrorists who will cause maximum damage to our people. Everybody accepts that disarmament of Saddam has to happen. Everybody accepts that he was supposed to cooperate fully with the inspectors. Everybody accepts that he is not doing so. So whatever the tactics within the UN, and that's something we can decide, whatever those tactics, the key point of principle is this, that when we came together last November and laid down Resolution 1441, now is the moment when we decide whether we meant it, and it was his final opportunity to disarm or face serious consequences, or whether alternatively we're simply going to drag out the diplomatic process forever. And that's why I say it's the point of decision.
Vote or not?
I was the guy that said they ought to vote, and one country voted. They showed their cards, I believe. It's an old Texas expression, show your cards when you're playing poker. France showed their cards. After I said what I said, they said they're going to veto anything that held Saddam to account. So cards have been played. And we'll just have to take an assessment after tomorrow to determine what that card meant. And let me say something about the UN. It's a very important organization. That's why I went there on September the 12th, 2002, to give the speech. The speech that called the UN into account, that said if you're going to pass resolutions, let's make sure your words mean something. Because I understand the wars of the 21st century are going to require incredible international cooperation. We're going to have to cooperate to cut off the money of the terrorists and the ability for nations, dictators who have weapons of mass destruction to provide training and perhaps weapons to terrorist organizations. We need to cooperate, and we are. Our countries up here are cooperating incredibly well. And the UN must mean something. Remember Rwanda. Or Kosovo, the UN didn't do its job. And we hope tomorrow the UN will do its job. If not, all of us need to step back and try to figure out how to make the UN work better as we head into the 21st century. Perhaps one way will be if we use military force in the post-Saddam Iraq. The UN will definitely need to have a role. And that way it can begin to get its legs of responsibility back. But it's important for the UN to be able to function well if we're going to keep the peace. And I will work hard to see to it that, at least from our perspective, that the UN is able to be a responsible body. And when it says something, it means it for the sake of peace and for the sake of the security, for the capacity to win the war of the first war of the 21st century, which is the war against terrorism and weapons of mass destruction in the hands of dictators. Thank you all.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. This is the end of the conference. Have a good trip.
Prime Minister José Durão Barroso of Portugal concluding a brief news conference at the conclusion of the brief Azores summit meeting. We heard from José María Aznar, the Prime Minister of Spain, President George W. Bush of the United States, and Prime Minister Tony Blair of the United Kingdom. And if you joined us late, the Prime Minister of Britain put it rather bluntly. We have reached the point of decision, he said. And in his address to the news media, President Bush put it even more bluntly. Here's what the President had to say.
We concluded that tomorrow is a moment of truth for the world. Many nations have voiced a commitment to peace and security, and now they must demonstrate that commitment to peace and security in the only effective way, by supporting the immediate and unconditional disarmament of Saddam Hussein.
I'm Neil Conan in Washington. With me are four of NPR's news correspondents to put the events of today into some perspective. Here with me in Studio 3A in Washington are NPR's diplomatic correspondent Vicky O'Hara, our national security correspondent Tom Jelton. With us on the line from Doha in Qatar is Steve Inskeep. That's the U.S. military headquarters in the Persian Gulf. And also with us is NPR's Don Gagne, our White House correspondent, who's traveling with the president. And Don Gagne, the president made it pretty clear that tomorrow is a moment of decision, not just an ultimatum to Iraq, but also to the United Nations.
He did indeed. He said it is time for other countries, countries that have supported the call to disarm Iraq by their vote on Resolution 1441 at the United Nations last November, to step forward and say if they mean it. It's also clear that these leaders have decided that tomorrow is the diplomatic deadline. It was a little tricky to try to figure out exactly what that deadline tomorrow meant. Are they going to bring that second resolution up for a vote tomorrow? Is it going to be, you know, some other kind of...
Excuse me, Don, the leaders are back at the microphones in the Azores. Okay. This is a surprise, and we're confused again. Clearly the moment about diplomatic resolutions is not only the only moment of confusion. Excuse me for interrupting you.
Yes. And they've been, you know, posing for pictures and other things here. But at any rate, tomorrow is the deadline. The president said tomorrow is the day that we determine if diplomacy can work. We'll see how we can best spend our time between now and tomorrow. He said we'll be working the phone. It sounds like if nations aren't going to get on board, nations on the Security Council, as far as this second resolution goes, then they can probably present whatever options and ideas they have. But once the clock strikes midnight tomorrow night, that's it, and we'll see how the president proceeds in terms of the timing of any announcements after that.
NPR's Vicky O'Hara, did you glean any more from what the president had to say as to how tomorrow might play out at the United Nations?
One of the reporters asked British Prime Minister Tony Blair very directly, you know, is this resolution going to be put to a vote, even with the veto threat? And Blair said, we will do with respect to the resolution what we believe is in the interests of the United Nations. Now, one might interpret that to mean that they will pull the resolution rather than have it go to a vote, face an almost certain veto, or to not even attract a majority of, you know, within the Security Council. The United States and British and the Spanish had hoped that even if the resolution were vetoed, they could at least get a nine-vote majority, that the nine votes that are needed for approval, simply to give any military action, you know, more appearance of international legitimacy. So it's possible that they would think that putting the resolution to a vote and having it voted down would hurt the United Nations, you know, long term.
In his last answer, though, the president said, look, I'm the one who said earlier, and that was in his news conference, that this should be put to a test and all the nations should show their cards. He also said France has shown its card. It was prepared to veto any resolution that called Iraq to account. In a way, this is an ultimatum to give France another day to decide what it's going to do with the United Nations.
Yes, I think in interviews with various administration officials throughout the day today, you've seen that message come across repeatedly. The pressure is on France is very, very strong. France has come under a lot of criticism in both London and in Washington for the position that it's taken, for its refusal to give Iraq an ultimatum for compliance. And I think that there's going to be a lot of diplomatic arm twisting between now and tomorrow.
So that on the diplomatic side, that, of course, dealing with what are normally described as American allies, moving to the military side, and that is in the confrontation with Saddam Hussein. There, the ultimatum, Tom Jelton, was equally clear.
It certainly is. In fact, at this point, you know, the goalposts have shifted, but it sounds from what the president said that the only thing at this point that Saddam Hussein could do is to leave the country and go into exile. So that's a pretty tall order.
One of the things that the president was talking about during his remarks was what would happen in a post-Saddam Iraq. And let's listen to what the president said. And particularly, I would urge not only to listen to the content of what he said, but listen to his verb tenses. Let's hear the tape.
To achieve this vision, we will work closely with the international community, including the United Nations and our coalition partners. If military force is required, we'll quickly seek new Security Council resolutions to encourage broad participation in the process of helping the Iraqi people to build a free Iraq.
So, there's some interesting verb tenses there, Tom Gelton. But he'd also talked about, in terms of Vicky's area of expertise and in terms of the importance of working through the United Nations in the post-war Iraq, new Security Council resolutions, that idea, but certainly his determination to use force if necessary, was absolutely clear.
It was. But let's stay for a moment on this issue of post-Saddam Iraq. Right now, it's the Pentagon, it's the U.S. military that is going to be in charge in post-Saddam Iraq. And I can tell you that there is a great deal of anxiety within the U.S. military about that responsibility and a sense of how great it will be, how great the challenge is. Iraq is a country of 25 million people. It's got a very highly developed bureaucracy. And once the United States finishes, the United States and its allies finish this military operation, the United States will be responsible for that country. It is not at all surprising to me that already we are seeing the United States saying, we're going to need help.
Steve Inskeep in Doha at the U.S. military headquarters there. You're not at the military headquarters, but that's where the military headquarters is, not far from where you are. Has there been talk there about how the United States troops, obviously their first concern is military operations, defeating the Republican Guard and the Special Republican Guard and that sort of thing. Yet, as Tom Gelton just mentioned, as soon as the United States enters Iraq, whatever portions of it Iraq it controls, the United States is responsible for the civilian population there. If it captures any prisoners, it's responsible for them as well.
Military officials, Neil, are already thinking about who is going to be, they would not say an army of occupation, but who is going to be around to provide security in Iraq after any war. And one thing that military officials are beginning to suggest is that some of these troops that have not made it to this region in time to participate in any attack, assuming it were to happen in the next few days or weeks, might be sent in later, and that they might become the forces that would provide stability in Iraq for some period of time. But this is a massive, massive task. A number of very senior military officials have suggested that it might easily take a quarter of the U.S. Army on a regular basis, on a rotating basis, to provide the kind of stability that you would need in a country of that size. And that's a huge commitment on top of all the other commitments the U.S. has in the world.
And Don Gagne, I know that you're going to be preparing to leave the Azores fairly soon to come back with the president to Washington, D.C. But I wanted to get any idea that you might have of the president's schedule over the next couple of days. Is there any indication? He talked about the importance of tomorrow as the showdown date. The idea, I guess, that the March 17th deadline in the British proposal that was tabled, the U.S.-British-Spanish resolution at the United Nations Security Council, that is still the operative date. And where the president goes from here?
The president, will no doubt be working the phones on Air Force One as he flies back to Washington. But we also know that he spent time on the flight here and presumably will spend time on the flight back working with two people he works with when he has to give an important speech. Karen Hughes, his former White House advisor who left the employ of the White House but who now still consults for the president, and Mike Gerson, the president's speechwriter, are traveling with him here. And they are clearly working on an important address. One other thing that's worth pointing out here, every Friday at the White House, there's a ritual. We get a look ahead, the week ahead, from the press secretary. This past Friday, we got no week ahead, and reporters today were pressing Ari Fleischer on Air Force One as to what his schedule looks like for the coming week, and all he would say is the president's schedule is flexible. And when pressed to go over it, he said there are events on the schedule, but there's a lot of flexibility on the schedule this week. So they're keeping things clear, and they are prepared to make whatever big statement they need to make.
Don Gagne, thanks very much. Vicky O'Hara, clearly the next 24 to 36 hours are going to be very busy diplomatically.
Yes, there are informal consultations tomorrow within the UN Security Council, and I'm sure that everyone will be talking to each other about what the president and what Tony Blair and Prime Minister Aznar had to say at the summit in the Azores. But the window, this diplomatic window, as the president put it, is rapidly closing. The president made that very clear today. And another 24 hours is not much time to try to bridge the very, very serious gaps within the Security Council.
Tom Gelton, there are any number of signs of imminent military operations. We've already seen some of them when all the military people involved hack their watches to Zulu time. That's the military equivalent of Greenwich Mean Time. When the protective suits that would protect forces against chemical or biological weapons, they have a limited lifespan once they're broken out, and they have been broken out. What are some of the other signs that you might look for as an indication that military operations are beginning to get underway?
Well, you know, the other fact that we haven't discussed today is Turkey. And Turkey has not yet, even to this moment, approved the deployment of U.S. troops on its soil or even allowed U.S. Planes to fly over Turkish airspace. And what that means is that the Navy aircraft carriers with dozens and dozens of U.S. warships on them will not be able to fly, it seems, over Turkish airspace. So in order for those aircraft to be used in a war, those aircraft carriers will have to move down into the Red Sea. That, I'm told, will take 36 to 48 hours. As soon as you see those aircraft carriers moving down in the Red Sea, you'll know that they're positioning themselves to be ready to undertake military action. Already there were about 13 cruisers, destroyers, and submarines that have already broken off from those battle groups, moved down into the Red Sea. Those are all ships and subs that fire cruise missiles. They're called shooters. They're already in the Red Sea, ready to go.
Vicky O'Hara, politically, the person in the most, the hottest water of those the quartet that we heard speaking at this summit meeting in the Azores has to be British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Let's listen to a cut of tape of what British Prime Minister Blair had to say as he discussed the idea of a final ultimatum to Iraq.
And we make a final appeal for there to be that strong, unified message on behalf of the international community that lays down a clear ultimatum to Saddam that authorizes force if he continues to defy the will of the whole of the international community set out in 1441. We will do all we can in the short time that remains to make a final round of contacts to see whether there is a way through this impasse.
Prime Minister Blair talking about the short time that remains. When he returns to London, he will be asked about the logic of going to war to enforce Security Council resolutions that the Security Council is apparently unwilling to enforce.
Yes, Tony Blair has been under great pressure politically at home because of opposition within his own political party and also overwhelming opposition among the British public to going to war without this second resolution. And that's one of the reasons that the United States has allowed this diplomatic process to continue. The United States does not want to leave its strongest ally, Tony Blair, you know, to hang out to dry if there is a war without a resolution and he pays a big price for it politically. So it's very important for Tony Blair's political future that this diplomatic effort be seen as having been taken as far as absolutely possible.
And Tom Gelton, before we let it go, it's important to remember that Britain is United States' most important military ally as well. Steve Inskeep was mentioning something like a third of the British Army is currently positioned in the Gulf.
Well, proportionally, a much bigger portion of the British military is positioned in the Gulf than the U.S. military. So this is by no means a token commitment on the part of Britain, nor is it, as you say, a symbolic commitment as far as the overall effort. Some 45,000 British troops are in position. Now, some of those, a good number of those, are likely to be kept back as a reserve force, but we do know that about 5,000 British special forces, and of course Britain has some of the top special forces in the world today, that many of those units will be used. closed. We've also understood that southern Iraq will largely be left for British troops to occupy.
If you joined us late, President Bush at the conclusion of the Azores summit said tomorrow is a moment of truth for the world. There will be a diplomatic resolution one way or another. It looks like the resolution may be pulled off the table or be voted up or down tomorrow at the United Nations. So stay tuned for news on that development. It also looks like, barring some dramatic development, something unexpected, that war is now a matter of days rather than weeks away. Thanks to my colleagues, to NPR's Steve Inskeep, who was with us from the Persian Gulf, to NPR's Tom Jelton, who was with us here in the studio, as well as Vicky O'Hara, and of course to Don Gagne, our White House correspondent, who was with us from Lajes Air Base in the Azores, where this summit meeting took place. You've been listening to special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We'll now return you to regularly scheduled programming. This is NPR News.
I think in the East has a chance. Again, there you have a number one seed in Oklahoma that's very good, but isn't on the level of Arizona or Kentucky. And first round upsets, which of course people are always looking for in the East, Penn over Oklahoma State, I think is really possible. Penn's an 11 seed and they can really shoot the basketball. And Weber State out of the Big Sky Conference over Wisconsin, a 12 over.
We interrupt this program for breaking news, a press conference with Secretary of State Colin Powell regarding possible war with Iraq.
...to the United Nations on the 12th of September and on the 8th of November, after long negotiations, passed UN Resolution 1441 by unanimous vote, 15-0, not one member failing to raise a hand in support of that resolution. In the months after the passage of UN Resolution 1441, we watched as the inspectors began their work, and we were immediately concerned that Iraq was not going to understand the intention of 1441 when Iraq submitted 30 days later a declaration that can only be said to be false, not complete, rather incomplete, not truthful, untruthful, and nowhere near meeting the spirit intended in 1441. We call that out to the international community at that time. We said we believe that that false declaration was a material breach. We continued to support the inspectors. We continued to watch. And although we have seen some process improvements and some grudging movement on the part of Saddam Hussein's regime to provide some information and provide some equipment to the inspectors, it certainly wasn't the kind of compliance and total cooperation that 1441 required, and that we were hoping but had no illusions about Iraq being able to accept and respond to. As a result of this, and as a result of a number of briefings that we received from UNMOVIC and IAEA a week and a half ago, the United Kingdom, the United States, and Spain put forward a resolution that would once again give Saddam Hussein one last chance to act or face the serious consequences that were authorized and clearly intended in UN Resolution 1441. Unfortunately, over the last roughly 2 weeks or thereabouts, a little less than 2 weeks, that we have debating this particular draft resolution, and despite best efforts to see whether or not language could be adjusted to make it more acceptable to council members, it is clear that there are some permanent members of the council that would veto any such resolution or any resolution resembling the one that the British tabled Friday before last at the United Nations. As a result of this, the United Kingdom, the United States, and Spain decided to not call for a vote on this resolution. We spent a great deal of time overnight and earlier this morning talking to friends and colleagues around the world about the resolution, and it was our judgment reached by the United States, the United Kingdom, and Spain that no further purpose would be served by pushing this resolution. So we are not going to ask for a vote on the resolution. The resolution will die anyway because it had a built-in date of 17 March within the resolution, which has not been modified. As you heard the president and the other leaders who assembled in the Azores yesterday for the Atlantic summit say, the window on diplomacy is closing. The moment of truth is arriving. And you will hear a speech from the president of the United States this evening. President Bush will address the nation and the world on the situation as we now see it. In his speech, he clearly will issue an ultimatum to Saddam Hussein that the only way to avoid the serious consequences that were built into 1441 is for Saddam Hussein and his immediate cohort to leave the country and to allow this matter to be resolved through the peaceful entry of force and not a conflict. Nevertheless, the president's determination will be made clear tonight that this matter cannot continue indefinitely, that Saddam Hussein is guilty of the charges that have been brought against him previously through these many resolutions which acknowledged that he had weapons of mass destruction, and he has failed to disarm himself as required by the various resolutions. We believe, and I think you've also heard an opinion from British legal authorities within the last 24 hours, that there is a sufficient authority in 1441, 678, and 687 earlier resolutions for whatever military action might be required. I'm very, very pleased that the Council did come together last November 8th for 1441. Of course, disappointed that we were unable to get a subsequent resolution, but we believe that our actions now are supported by international law, whatever actions we might take in the future, and the President will talk to this issue tonight. I won't say any more about the President's speech because the President, of course, will have the opportunity to speak for himself and make the points perfectly clear to the American people and to the international community. You'll also notice that in their statements yesterday at the Atlantic Summit, all of the leaders spoke to a future for Iraq that will be brighter if it comes to the use of military force, where this dictator will no longer be able to oppress his own people, no longer able to threaten his neighbors, and no longer able to develop these horrible weapons which could be used against his neighbors as they have been used in the past, or of greater concern to us, can spread and be acquired by terrorist organizations which might use them against us, our friends, or our interests. I think it was also important to note in the President's statement yesterday his commitment to the UN and the role that we believe the UN will play in the aftermath of any conflict, should it come, and our continued support for the UN. With that, I'll take a couple of questions,
Secretary,
and I have to go.
On the Allies, yeah. Mm-hmm. Back in November, when several of them tried to dilute the resolution, and they did accomplish some word changes, would it be fair to say that they understood at the end that force was possible? Because they seemed to give the impression they had succeeded in sidetracking force. And could you say if you think there'll be permanent damage to the alliance with what the French have done with support from Germany and Russia?
On your first question, Barry, there can be no confusion on this point. If you remember the debate that we were having before 1441 was passed, there were some nations who insisted that a second resolution would be required. And we insisted that a second resolution would not be required. And as we negotiated our way through that, we made it absolutely clear that we did not believe that the resolution as it finally passed would require a second resolution. And in fact, the resolution that we are not taking to a vote today is not a resolution that we believed was necessary. It was a resolution we were supporting along with the United Kingdom, who tabled it, and Spain. It was a resolution that would help some of our friends to show to their publics and to the world that we had taken one last step. We had made one last effort to see if Saddam Hussein would come into compliance. The burden of this problem rests squarely on Saddam Hussein and his continuing efforts to deceive, to deny, to do everything to divide the council, to take advantage of every meeting we have had over the last several months to do something just before that meeting to suggest that he is complying when he really isn't. And the world should know that this crisis is before us because of this regime and its flagrant violation of obligations that it entered into over the last 12 years. That's where the burden lies.
And is there permanent damage?
Excuse me. Is there permanent damage to
the alliance?
The UN is an important institution, and it will survive. And the United States will continue to be an important member of the United Nations and its various organizations. But clearly, this is a test, in my judgment, that the Security Council did not meet. We all knew what we were doing last fall. the very reason that we went into a prolonged negotiation on 1441 was so that it did not become the same kind of resolution that we had seen so many times in the past, that had a lot of words, a lot of rhetoric, and Saddam Hussein can simply ignore and thumb his nose at. This was a resolution that every person who voted for it, every permanent representative who was there on the 8th of November and voted for this resolution knew that it was different, that serious consequences would flow, and those serious consequences meant the use of force to disarm Saddam Hussein if he did not comply with that resolution and cooperate fully with the inspectors to disarm that regime.
Mr. Secretary, how long a period of time do you think is appropriate for Saddam Hussein to be allowed to get out, and who else besides him would have to leave if they want to avert war?
I won't speak to a time limit. The President may do that in his speech this evening, and I'll leave that to him. But clearly, we would want to see Saddam Hussein depart, as well as immediate members of his family who are in positions of control and authority over the armed forces of Iraq. And there are a number of other individuals who would also like to see depart. Some of them were mentioned in the weekend press. But it's not just one individual, I think, to solve the problem.
Do you have a number, though? Is there a specific number?
I don't have a number at hand. There are a variety of numbers and ideas floating around. And if somebody in Baghdad wishes to know the names, I'm sure we'd be able to provide them.
Secretary, can you give us some insight what has happened over the last 24 hours since the meeting in the Azores? Who were the problems? What kind of conversations did you have? Who did you reach out to? And what were the responses?
The United Kingdom obviously reached out to a number of their colleagues, and I can't speak for them. I'll let them cover their own calls and consultations. Similarly, Spain and others. Richard will give you the list of my calls for this morning, but it's about 12 or 15. I've spoken to the French, just spoke to Foreign Minister de Villepin. I spoke to Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer of Germany. I've spoken to Foreign Minister Igor Ivanov of the Russian Federation. I've spoken to the new Chinese Foreign Minister, Foreign Minister Li. I've spoken to President Musharraf. I have spoken to Kofi Annan. I have spoken to Foreign Minister George Papandreou of Greece, who's also in the Greek presidency for this period. I've spoken to Foreign Secretary Straw. I've spoken to Foreign Minister Palacios of Spain. And there's a very long list waiting when I get back upstairs. The response was, this is where we are. Does anybody see any prospects for movement on this particular resolution? And frankly, everybody pretty much accepted that this resolution was not going to be a successful one because there was one nation, France, that had indicated that it would veto it under any set of circumstances or any similar resolution as modified that would leave a path open to conflict. But we always knew from the very beginning that such a path had to be kept open. And this is what serious consequences meant. And without that path, Saddam Hussein would never comply. And what he was trying to do was just stretch it out. More inspections, more time, let's delay, let's give a little here, give a little there. Let's see if we can break this consensus. And with the certainty of a French veto and possibly other vetoes, this was not the time to have further division within the council by taking this to a vote. I've got one. Excuse me. Yeah.
Mr. Secretary, you seem to imply yesterday in one of the shows that you believe French commercial interests would help drive the position. I'm wondering if you can elaborate on that. And how firm a guarantee do we have that Turkey won't send its troops well into northern Iraq and cause problems with the Kurds there?
I made the point that they're, in response to the question, that of course they're commercial interests that everybody has to consider. And the French have for years had difficulties with the inspection regime, and I pointed out in one of the shows yesterday that when you go back to 1998 and early 1999, when the current inspection regime was being developed, when UNMOVIC was being created after the collapse of the previous inspection regime, France worked actively for a number of months, in our judgment, to try to weaken that inspection regime. And at the end of the day, when compromises had been made and everybody thought we had a good outcome before our time, the previous administration, even then, France abstained from voting for it. And so that is of concern to us. But in 1441, France was solidly on board. And when you look at the statements that were made by French officials right after the passage of 1441, it was absolutely clear that they understood that Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi regime had weapons of mass destruction. It's not something just known to American intelligence. It's known to all of the major intelligence agencies in the world. And France acknowledged that. Everybody acknowledged that when they signed on to 1441, because that's what it says. It said Iraq is in material breach, has been in material breach, and now has the opportunity to either get out of the problem or get into further material breach. And what they did was get into further material breach. And that's our judgment, and we believe that the test of the resolution has been met with respect to the appropriateness of application of serious consequences.
And the Turks and the Kurds?
Barbara? Yeah. I'm sorry. On the Turks and the situation in northern Iraq, we are in the closest consultation with the Turks, and let me say that we are very sensitive to Turkish concerns. We appreciate the fact that the Turkish government did take our request for deployments into their parliament at a difficult time for them, with a prime minister who was still coming in, so to speak. Mr. Erdogan was not the prime minister at that time. And we are in the closest touch with them now on a number of issues. One, the possibility of resubmission, and he is committed to do that at a time that he believes is appropriate. And secondly, we don't think it would be useful right now to create any additional tension on the border between Turkey and northern Iraq, and we are in discussions with them as to how to make sure that tensions can be kept at the lowest point and not to have difficulty in northern Iraq of the kind that concerns them. And we have also assured the Turks that in anything that the future might hold, we are committed to the territorial integrity of Iraq.
I wanted to ask just some personal reflections. After 1441 was passed, you were a very, very happy man, and certainly it was quite a triumph. How have you been feeling the last few weeks? When did you realize that this was not going to happen? Do you wish you'd done anything differently? Do you wish you'd traveled more, changed your tactics in any way?
This legend that is out there now, that Colin Powell, the first variation of it was he doesn't travel, and the next variation was he hates to travel, and the third variation was he will never travel and doesn't want to travel. You do your job by personal contact, by travel, and by the use of modern technology so that you can get more bang for the time. And so in the last 6 weeks, I have had four personal one-on-one meetings, direct meetings, with the French foreign minister, with the British foreign minister, with the Russian foreign minister, five such meetings with the Chinese foreign minister. I have gone to Davos in Switzerland, where I addressed an international setting, and at that meeting I met with the Turkish prime minister for almost 2 hours, and the incoming Turkish Prime Minister, Mr. Erdogan. I have had the Turkish delegation here in the department, a full delegation, the foreign minister, the finance minister, and they came to my home till midnight as we worked on the economic package. And so I believe that I have used my time properly. At the same time, I went to Asia a few weeks ago, so I travel when I believe travel is appropriate. I like to travel more. But you know, the Secretary of State has many responsibilities that he or she has to deal with, and one has to balance it all. But I assure you that I do not shrink back from traveling, and I will be traveling again soon.
But any regrets, anything you've done differently?
No. I mean, you can always look and say you should have done this, should have done that. But the fact of the matter is, we came up with a good resolution, and we got a solid vote for it, 15-0. And then for a period of 4 months after that, we worked hard with the inspectors. We provided them intelligence. The focus really was at the UN in New York, not, you know, a lot of other places. That's where we had to concentrate our effort. And we did everything we could to try to persuade the council that what they were seeing was not compliance. What they were seeing was passive cooperation that didn't get to the heart of the matter, which was a strategic decision by Saddam Hussein to comply. And that's what we weren't able to get, and that's what we weren't able to convince some members of the council is what was needed in order for us to believe that Saddam Hussein was a changed regime, was leading a changed regime that was willing now to cooperate with the international community and comply with its obligations. One last one, sir.
Mr. Secretary, you said that the ultimatum would be for Saddam Hussein to leave Iraq. Is there any form of disarmament or cooperation at this stage which could save his skin?
I think the time for diplomacy has passed. I think that's pretty clear. That's what the leaders were saying in the Azores yesterday. We used last evening and this morning to consult broadly around the world. We did, the British did, the Spanish did. A lot of people have been talking to each other this morning and overnight, and it became clear that it would be best at this time to withdraw the resolution, and I can think of nothing that Saddam Hussein could do diplomatically. I think that time is now over. He had his chance. He's had many chances over the last 12 years, and he has blown every one of those chances. Thank you.
Thank you.